Commission recommendations go far beyond the healthcare system. A massive mobilization of resources, a Green New Deal, is needed to confront climate change, which poses myriad threats to public health. The U.S. spends 3.4% of its GDP on the military, while G7 countries with lower mortality rates only spend an average of 1.4% of GDP on defense. If the U.S. reduces foreign intervention and military spending to 1.4% of GDP, a massive amount of resources could be redirected to urgent social needs. Additionally, the war on drugs must come to an end, and new investments should be made in communities of color harmed by the criminal legal system and mass incarceration, according to the commission. While the wealthy have thrived, most Americans have lost ground, both economically and medically, said Steffi Woodhandler, who co-chairs the Lancet Commission and lectures at Hunter College in Harvard. The Biden administration must reboot democracy and implement the progressive social health policies needed to put the country on the road to better life.
Midstream.
We are on the side of the oppressed, whichever pole they may be in. Palestinians are oppressed by the Israelis, therefore we side with them. This is one of many quotes of late Imam Ruhullah Musawi Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Approaching the 32nd passing anniversary of Imam Khomeini, remember his efforts in warning the Islamic world to the dangers of the creation of the usurping Israeli entity. There is no doubt that Al-Quds al-Sharif holds a prodigious position in the hearts and minds of monotheistic religions in general and among Muslims in particular due to the religious sanctities that this city contains, such as the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock. In addition to that, it was the first Qibla to which Muslims prayed before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, converted the Qibla to the Holy Kaaba in the city of Mecca. Accordingly, there is no disagreement or conflict between the people of all religions over its sanctity and high status. Muslims continued to make pilgrimage to it just like they did to the Holy Kaaba until the Zionist entity seized the holy city of Al-Quds entirely in 1967 and became an obstacle prohibiting Muslims from reaching their holy city. As such, Imam Khomeini, since the establishment of the usurper entity, tried to alert the Islamic world to the danger of that entity, not only to Jerusalem and Palestine that it had occupied, but to all our Arab and Islamic world. His Eminence worked to establish a true Islamic awareness to link Muslims with Al-Quds and Palestine so that Jerusalem would become an issue in the mind, heart, moral, spiritual, and missionary entity of every Muslim. Making said Muslims a barrier of defense and resistance against Zionist gangs that occupied it after it had occupied most of Palestine and expelled its people. Palestine took the lion's share in Imam Khomeini's speeches, making all Muslims bear the responsibility to defend their faithful cause, as global Zionism aims from the occupation of Palestine to control the capabilities of the Islamic world and humiliate it. Therefore, liberating Palestine implies getting rid of a major terrorist plot. And this is exactly what Imam Khomeini's legacy towards Palestine presents. It presents the foundation of a renaissance project to confront the great danger of Zionism expansion in West Asia. Welcome to the Middle Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Statements of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini reveals that the Palestinian cause occupied an advanced position in the principles and interests of the late Imam. He promised us that we will see Palestine liberated and that the Israelis will be expelled from our region with the firm determination of the people of this region. Imam Khomeini made it clear that we will expel the Zionists who are still displacing and killing our children and aspiring to expand in our land and all of our region. Since the early 1960s, late Imam Khomeini began his long struggle against imperialism and Zionism, making Palestine the Arab and Muslim central cause and its liberation the top priority. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, producer and creative director at Islamic Pulse. Thank you very much for being with us, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar. Starting with Imam Ruhullah's struggles through the world, the sermons, the meetings, the speeches that he delivered, he used to conduct in various places in all times. He always mentioned Palestine, made it a central cause for him and a top priority as well for the Islamic Republic of Iran. How do you explain the effect of Imam's words on the awakening of the Muslim Ummah?
The Imam certainly had a profound impact on all Muslims. Oftentimes we make the mistake of relegating Imam Khomeini as just a Shia leader. But this is not the case. The reality is that when the Islamic Revolution had begun and there were people on the streets of Iran and they were chanting slogans and they were saying that we neither want the East nor do we want the West, we want Islam, Islam, it was not just Shias, it was Sunnis too. In fact, it was not just Iranians. Across the region, the Islamic region, all the Muslim countries pretty much, there were people on the streets too. There were people who were starting to chime those very same sentiments. That revolutionary spirit exploded out of Iran and it spread across the region. Now, you can imagine, at that time, there were two superpowers in the world. There was America in the West, and there was the Soviet Union in the East. These two superpowers wished to control the minds and the pockets of the Muslims across the region. And so when they saw that Sunnis and Shias are all proclaiming that they wish to bring about a revolution and bring about an Islamic Republic, just like they're bringing into Iran, those superpowers became very intimidated. It shook the world. And again, I have to emphasize this point. It was not just Shias who were inspired by Imam Khomeini's words. I'll give you an example. One of the most prominent speakers in the Sunni world is Ahmad Dida. Many people will recognize him as being the teacher of Zakir Naik. Now, Ahmad Dida, he would often speak with the Christians and the Jews, and he would debate with them. What does Ahmad Dida say? And many of you will have seen this clip, and it's available online, where he says, I went to Iran, and I witnessed Imam Khomeini with my own eyes. And I don't know what it is about the man, but when I see him, my eyes just started to overflow with tears. Mm-hmm. Remember, this is Ahmad Dida, a Sunni speaker. Mm-hmm. And then he says that everything about the man was Quran. He says it's just Quran. He was emanating the Quran in his words, in his actions. You see, the Quran is a unifying phenomenon. It is common, whichever school of thought you may belong to, the Quran is the universally understood and accepted immaculate word of God. And so Imam Khomeini had completely amalgamated himself into this divine book.
Well, now, Sheikh Haidar, this is very interesting, but fast forward to what's happening, especially in the last couple of days with the normalization times with the Israeli entity happening. We did hear back in the day Imam Khomeini viewing the Israeli entity with suspicion and repeating his warnings to the entire world, not only to the regional, to the Islamic Ummah in the region, but he kept saying that the Zionists will try and subordinate their presence across all of the region and probably the rest of the world. Can you tell me what do you think his thoughts and his teachings, how do you think that collided with last year's normalization with the entity by a number of Arab states?
Well, it's actually very fascinating, sister, because if you look at the philosophy of Imam Khomeini, he not only had this unifying philosophy, but he also had a staunch stance against the Zionist entity of Israel. And if I'm correct, he even stated that, look, with America even, we can have diplomacy. There is a chance that we can have talks with America, provided that they change some of their policies, even though America is the great Satan, according to the words of Imam Khomeini. However, the Zionist entity of Israel, there was no space for any diplomacy, because Imam Khomeini was very clear and very explicit. Israel is a cancer. What's a cancer? Is a cancer. It is not a country. It's not a normal nation that can be discussed with, traded with, have an embassy for. No. Israel is that despicable entity which has usurped the lands of Muslims. They don't actually, the Zionists don't belong there at all. This was the philosophy of Imam Khomeini. Very simple and very easy to understand. And so we saw that many Sunnis, many Shiites came on board with that mission and that overall perspective. And when we see these Arab so-called Muslim governments are normalizing ties with the Zionist entity, it's a tragedy. And what they've essentially done is they have betrayed Imam Khomeini. What did Imam Khomeini stand for? He stood for Islam. He stood for the Quran. These so-called Muslim governments out there have actually betrayed the ethos of the Quran. And with your permission, I'd like to recite a verse of the Quran because it highlights exactly what we're talking about here.
But
it says very
the magnificent effort of the resistance, though, slowed down this normalization process. Actually, put a hurdle in this process in the Arab world, because people in the Arab world are against it even before it was announced. But now, after Palestine, after what happened to Gaza and how Gaza retaliated with this magnificent power against the Zionist entity, why did it take blood, though, for to be shed by the Palestinians, for these Arabs living in those states to understand that it's important for them to be vocal about their stances?
You're absolutely right. It's a huge shame, actually, that it took this amount of bloodshed before these Arab nations. Maybe they start to recognize it now. But look, it was about this verse of the Quran: "In tantaru Allaha yansurkum wa yuthabbit aqdamakum." If you help Allah, Allah will help you, and He will make firm your feet. The resistance, the unified resistance of the noble Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, showed the world. It shook the world again, because it showed that Israel, with all of their military might and all of their backing from America and the other world powers, could not stand against a unified effort from the Palestinians. And so what this did is it had repercussions upon those so-called Arab nations. And what's happening is we saw that there was public support. This public support should not be underestimated, not just in the Muslim world, but across the world. You look, you saw it yourself, sister, in the UK, in the United States, in Australia, in every country in the world pretty much. We saw that there were united efforts from Muslims and non-Muslims alike standing up.
But there is one question in my mind, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, about Iran is obviously not the only Muslim country that supports Palestine and the right of return and the right for liberation. We have other states, for example, like Turkey. But we all hear, all that we hear coming from Turkey, for example, are words. Why did they not adopt the approach that is brought upon by the teachings of Imam Khomeini to at least ensure that resistance can defend itself by itself?
Well, it requires an essay answer, but to keep it short and simple, sister, it requires faith. When we're talking about Imam Khomeini, often people relegate him to just the arena of politics. No, this was a man of faith, and his politics was the divine politics of the prophets and the awliya. It requires faith, and not every country, and not most people, it's very difficult to adopt that faith. Look, when Imam Khomeini comes out and says, if every Muslim in the world was to throw a bucket of water at the Zionist entity, it would just flood, it would wash away. Now, it requires faith to believe in that, and I feel that that is the main trait that was missing. Another thing is this idea of the world. People get bribed, they get drawn towards this materialistic dunya. And so Turkey, a nation like Turkey, you often see the sentiments of Turkey wishing to be associated with the Europeans. They want this kind of image for themselves. And so it never allows them to get off the fence and properly support the oppressed people of Palestine. When Imam Khomeini, you know, he said to the people that, look, if they threaten us, if the enemies threaten us with sanctions, then we are the children of Ramadan. And if they threaten us with physically attacking us, then we are the children of Muharram. Faith is really the missing ingredient. If anybody truly wishes to support the oppressed Palestinian cause and any oppressed in the world, you need to have faith. And that's what Imam Khomeini gave to the people of Iran and the region. I don't think Turkey, the government of Turkey, actually understood that message. They'd be in a different place right now if they had.
I want to thank you very much, Sheikh Muzaffar Haider, Creative Director at Islamic Pulse, for joining us to talk about this very important matter. It's not enough for me. I need more time to talk to you. This is such an important matter. And what you said is absolutely amazing. It's much needed to be heard on TV for people to hear it, especially the teachings of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the UN Human Rights Council decided to open an investigation into the war crimes on the Palestinian people.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The UN Human Rights Council decided on Thursday to create an open-ended international investigation into violations surrounding the latest Israeli aggression against Gaza, accusing Israel of systematic abuses in the Palestinian territories and inside Israeli-occupied cities as well. UN officials said they saw no evidence that civilian buildings in Gaza hit by Israeli fighter jets were being used for any military purposes to begin with. Rather, the aggression was disproportionate and might constitute war crimes. More on this following report.
It did not take long after the end of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, in which the Israeli entity committed war crimes against Palestinian civilians, until the Human Rights Council voted to establish an independent international investigation committee to investigate the Israeli aggression and to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and international human rights law in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem and within the 1948 territories. The resolution was adopted in the Council after its draft was presented by Pakistan, with 24 countries voting for it, 14 abstaining, and 9 opposing, namely Uruguay, Britain, Austria, Germany, Marshall Islands, Malawi, Bulgaria, Cameroon, and the Czech Republic. On the other hand, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs responded by noting that it had previously boycotted the United Nations fact-finding mission in 2009, and that it also now rejects the decision, stressing that it would not cooperate with the investigation. The United States of America also expressed deep regret at the decision of the Human Rights Council, claiming this resolution threatens to obstruct the current progress in the region, citing the humiliating normalization attempts by irrelevant puppet Arab states. What is important about this decision is that for the first time, a permanent rather than a temporary one-year investigation committee will be formed, and at an international level, to examine the Israeli violations against the Palestinians in the 1948 occupied territories as well. It is also important because it represents the first time that the Human Rights Council addresses the root causes of the systematic Israeli racial discrimination against the native Palestinian people in occupied Palestinian territories of 1967. Meanwhile, a number of Palestinian human rights institutions are preparing to submit requests for an international investigation into war crimes and violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law committed by the Israeli occupation forces during the last battle, in addition to requests that will be directed to European countries to put officials in the occupation army on trial for their responsibility for killing civilians in Gaza.
To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Eva Bartlett, independent journalist who has lived in Gaza before. Thank you for being with us, Eva, in this segment about the Israeli war crimes against the people of Palestine. Now, Israel targeted several residential areas in Gaza, killing civilians killing, actually more than 200 civilians, half of whom were children, as you may know. However, this is not the first time that they do that inside of Gaza. Yet, it is the first time that the UNSC dared to declare this aggression as a possible war crime and took vote to begin an investigation in Gaza and elsewhere in the 1948 and 1967 Palestinian territories. What was it this time that pushed the UN to actually do this?
Well, for example, when I was in Gaza during the 2008-2009 massacre, it wasn't easy to get the news out about the Israeli war crimes that Israel is committing. So, for example, I would document something and then rush back to one of the media buildings to then try to get it out to the world. But, you know, a decade later, more people in Gaza have access to smartphones and to internet, so they can live stream, they can document in real time Israel's war crimes. And there are many Palestinians in Gaza who have done that in previous wars and in this last war. So therefore, the UN can't ignore it anymore. You know, previously it was easy for them to say, well, we're not sure what's going on. But when you have so many people documenting the manifold Israeli war crimes, then people around the world also are seeing it and are horrified by what's going on. So I think it's the combination of Palestinians having the technology to document themselves Israel's war crimes, and then that documentation getting out as it's happening.
Well, Eva, you lived in Gaza during Israel's incremental genocide against the people of the native Palestinians in Gaza in 2009 and in 2012 as well, and you've witnessed the tactics with your own eyes. Can you maybe unfold some of the tragic incidents that you witnessed as an independent journalist, which definitely amounts to a war crime, especially against the media and medics inside of Gaza?
Absolutely. So in the 2009 massacre of Gaza, I was among a handful of activists riding with the Palestinian Red Crescent and their ambulances. And I was mostly in northern Gaza, so I was seeing a very hard-hit area where Israel committed numerous war crimes, including using white phosphorus. And I know people are aware of the Hakura school, which Israel hit, with Palestinian internally displaced people that had fled from their areas that were either being occupied by the Israeli army or being bombed by the Israeli army. And they had fled to this UN school for which the Israelis had the coordinates, and yet Israel bombed that school. But I documented Israel's wide use of white phosphorus in Al Atatra, which is in northern Gaza, in Gaza City itself, in the Zaytun area, in Sheikh Rajlin, and even on the rehabilitation center, the Wafa Rehabilitation Center in eastern Gaza. So the use of white phosphorus on a civilian population is a war crime. Israel's targeting medics is a war crime as well, and at least two medics I knew that were targeted. One was shot at with a dart bomb, a flechette bomb, as he stood in his uniform next to his ambulance, and he died as a result of the dart bomb that shredded him, and he went into shock and died. The other medic I was with, his name's Hassan, and we were in an ambulance going to pick up a corpse at the Ezbet Abed Rabbo crossroads, and Hassan and Jamal, two medics also in uniforms, during ceasefire hours in which civilians and medics should be able to work without being targeted by Israeli snipers, they came under sniper fire and had to run for their lives, the sniper fire coming right up to the ambulance that I was in. So there's the issue of targeting medics, and thereby, by the way, targeting medics, they're preventing medics from reaching the civilians that desperately need aid, which is also against the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. But in terms of other Israeli war crimes, they point-blank assassinated children. There's the Ezbet Abed Rabbo family, Khaled Abed Rabbo, his two children, ages 2 and 7, were point-blank assassinated by an Israeli soldier. A family that I met after the fact, their one-year-old daughter was point-blank, was targeted by an Israeli sniper. The Israelis rounded up dozens of the Samuni clan in, I believe it was in Zaytun, outside the outskirts of Gaza City, rounded them up, put them in one home, and then bombed it.
Well, the level of horror.
And I'm sorry, Mari, you did mention media buildings. Israel, as we know in this past war on Gaza, Israel targeted, I believe it was at least 3 high-rise media buildings, mm-hmm. One of which, the Shuruk building, the Israelis had targeted in 2009 when I was in the building, shelling it at least 7 times with, I believe it was either a tank or Apache fire. Mm-hmm. They also targeted it in 2012 and 2014, and then this last time they completely destroyed it, yeah, as they did the Jawhara Tower.
Yeah.
And we know that in doing so, clearly this was because they wanted to try as much as they could to prevent Palestinian journalists from documenting what would be many war crimes to follow.
Well, Ava, one of the incidents you once told me about, we were chatting about this issue, and you told me about when Israeli occupation forces opened fire at farmers in Gaza, and you were actually there, but thank God you were not hurt. Could you tell us more about maybe the testimonies briefly about such incidents that the people of Gaza endure while they are being besieged by the Israeli entity?
Yeah, this is a particularly sadistic aspect of the siege on Gaza. They, as we know, they prevent Palestinians from importing or exporting, which is decimating their economy, but then they prevent them from fishing and farming by targeting fishers and farmers with heavy machine gun fire, in the case of fishers, even targeting them with missiles, abducting them, taking their boats and not returning them. In the case of farmers, over the course of the 3 years that I was living in Gaza, I and other activists were accompanying farmers on their land, which was usually 500 or 600 meters from the fence encircling Gaza, encaging Gaza. And Israelis say that the 300 meters on the Gaza side of that fence is a no-go zone in which Palestinians, if they dare to tread, will be arrested or shot dead, usually the latter.
Even if they are farmers.
Yes, these are farmers. You can see quite clearly they are unarmed. They are clearly farmers. And these include not only just young men of labor, young laborers, but also children and elderly, entire families working on their land. The Israeli jeeps will either shoot at them from, the Israeli soldiers will either get out of jeeps and shoot at them, or they'll use a remote-controlled gun tower.
Well, Ava, in a minute or less than that, we also saw the Israeli war crimes, not only in the enclaved Gaza Strip, but also in the 1948 and 1967 occupied territories inside of Palestine, like, for example, Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where a number of families are facing imminent forced displacement by the occupation. But we also saw harmony between the internal Palestinian, occupied Palestinian land and Gaza. Do you think that this experience of unity can actually be built upon for the future of Palestine?
Yeah, it was a historic time because, as we know, there are various factors that have created division amongst Palestinians. I would say, first and foremost, the occupation, the physical occupation, keeping Palestinians apart from one another, but also other divisive means of keeping Palestinians not unified. But what we saw recently with all the resistance factions unifying and sending a very strong message to Israel that they are standing with the Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and with Al-Quds, of course, this was rather unprecedented, and I think that this is a powerful message to their occupiers that the game has changed. They can no longer kill wantonly and displace Palestinians wantonly. They will pay a price.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ava Bartlett, independent journalist who had a very immense and deep experience of the occupation and the genocide inside of Gaza, for joining us to talk about the Israeli war crimes against the people of Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us, Ava.
Thank you.
Please do stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In his speech on the anniversary of the passing of Imam Khomeini on the 3rd of June 2020, Ayatollah Khamenei spoke about the transformations which Imam Khomeini brought about in Iran and the Iranian nation. Transforming people's outlook about the future and creation of modern Islamic civilization. Inner the transformation was changing the people's mentality about the future. During the time when revolutionary activities began and when Imam entered the arena, despite the slogans that some parties, groups and individuals, which were very limited and small in number, chanted, the people did not see a future. They did not envisage a future ahead of them that gave to the creation of the new Islamic civilization. If you look at the Iranian nation today, you see the blessed hands of Imam as the architect of this condition. The people are looking towards creating a new Islamic civilization, forging a great Islamic alliance and establishing the Islamic Ummah. In the present time, this is the outlook of the masses of the people. Transforming people's attitude towards the young generation and trusting them. Another area of transformation that Imam brought about was a change in the outlook towards youth. He trusted the thoughts and actions of the youth. That was a transformation in the true sense of the word. For example, when the Islamic Revolution, God's Corps, was formed, he placed 20 plus year old youth at the top of this organization. They were youth who were at most 30 years old. They were top of the God's Corps, and they were commanders and generals. Those youths were entrusted with big tasks. The same was true of other areas. He had astonishing trust in the youth whom he believed in, and he gave them responsibilities in the judiciary and other areas. He assigned them different roles, and he trusted their thoughts and their actions. Transforming people's viewpoint about world powers and believing in the possibility of their defeat. At that time, before the Islamic Revolution, no one believed that one could say something different from what the US said and do something different from what the US did. However, Imam acted in a way that US presidents admitted that Khomeini humiliated us. And that was the truth of the matter.
Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
supporters.
The fifth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA concludes in Vienna. The objective, to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure the full implementation of Iran's nuclear commitments. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the sticking points are fewer than they were a week ago.
It's a complex process with political decisions, with rather technical issues. They go in parallel. Now we are reaching a point in which we have to face the hard decisions. That's why it's only logical that head of delegations will go back to capitals. They will expose to their authorities the situation, and they will come back, I hope, with new, fresh ideas to finally close the negotiation.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said although the sides have made good progress, some key issues still need to be resolved. Iran has demanded the removal of all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the former U.S. administration, saying it would only return to full compliance after the verification of sanctions removal.
It's certainly the other side who has to make difficult decisions. What we need to do at the same time is on the implementation plans, decide on the methods and ways which meet our interest most. But for the US, for the other side, for Europeans, it is time to make difficult decisions. And I hope that they would be able to do that.
The Joint Commission will meet again in a week's time. And though the EU coordinator said he is absolutely sure the next round will be the last, Iran's lead delegate opted for a more cautious stance, saying that nothing can be predicted in such difficult negotiations. Homolesky, Vienna.
The European Commission reports that 45% of adults in the EU have now received their first dose of COVID-19 vaccine. In its latest budget policy recommendations under Economic Semester 2021, the Commission claims the vaccine rollout is providing hope.
Restrictions are being eased, and also more affected sectors are gradually again opening for business.
There is no official data available yet, but it is clear that right across the EU, businesses allowed to reopen in recent weeks simply have not. Government funding to support businesses while they were closed and financial support to keep jobs afloat is now being cut. This means the true scale of the economic crisis in the EU is very unclear at the moment. The bloc is on course, though, to vaccinate most adults before September the 1st. However, economists say that will not prove to be the proverbial silver bullet. Getting things back to how they were prior to COVID-19 will take years, they warn. Concern persists over the possibility that, as they emerge, new strains of COVID-19 might be resistant to existing vaccines.
Uncertainty is still high. We do not yet know what lasting effects the crisis will leave, and also the exact impact of the recovery and resilience facility.
Even before we get to learn about the real data in the coming months, things are already bad.
The youth unemployment rate remains more than double the average unemployment rate.
Experts say the EU needs to focus much more on creating quality jobs for young people.
The European Union definitely needs to continue working and invest more money on young people. This is definitely a crucial point. As you also said, we are the future of the population in Europe.
There is massive government and personal debt in the EU. The European Commission has announced it will not enforce austerity on the 27 member states until 2023. The question is, how will citizens be impacted when that does start happening again? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After the Israeli airstrike hit Al-Kolak family building in the Gaza Strip, Zainab Al-Kolak was rescued by the civil defense after spending 12 hours under the rubble of her home. Zainab survived, but at least 30 members of her family were killed by the Israeli raid in the latest escalation against Gaza. After repeated failures to extricate her from the rubble, rescue workers finally saved Zainab Al-Kolak, a 22-year-old Palestinian woman who lost her family members in an Israeli airstrike on their house in the Gaza Strip.
We all gathered in a room watching news, and I was using my phone. We heard two missiles hitting somewhere really close. We heard bombing before, but this one was different, and the home was shaking. We got really scared, and we even forgot to take our bags of important things that we prepared for any possible bombing. My mom and my only sister were next to me. The last thing I remember was everyone scared and didn't know what was happening. The roof fell on our heads. In less than a second, I found myself under the rubble.
Stuck under the rubble, Zainab used her cell phone and called the Gaza ambulance service, hoping they could help her and save her family. But it took hours until they saved her from the rubble because Israeli regime destroyed the main roads leading to her home and the hospital.
I was holding my phone while trapped under the rubble. The voices of my mom and sister just disappeared, and I started to call people. I don't know how I remembered the numbers of civil defense. I called them, but they couldn't reach me. I started to call my friends, Shaima and Fatima, but I wasn't able to tell them I was under the rubble. I spent 12 hours there. I just imagined that when I called the civil defense, they would save us fast. But it took long to reach us, and eventually I lost the hope to stay alive.
Zainab, who studies English literature and is interested in arts, expressed that no words can describe her feeling of losing her family. While Zainab's father is still at hospital receiving treatment, Zainab is now worried about her new burdens and responsibilities after losing her mother.
This is not the first time Israel has done such a massacre. We lived our lives just between one war and another. We thought we were safe, but no one is. They hit us with no prior notice. We were a big family, and now I can count us on one hand. I used to be a normal student, and now I have millions of things to take care of as life throws me in the middle of everything.
Zainab and her family members are not the only victims of the Israeli attacks. 11 days of Israeli air, land, and sea assaults on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children. The strikes also wounded more than 1,900 people before a ceasefire went into effect on May the 21st. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's latest report on Iran is the first since the country stopped implementing voluntary transparency measures as a result of a law passed by Parliament restricting agency access to nuclear facilities. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the IAEA valid until the 24th of June, the agency will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the agency had no access that had previously been provided under the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA.
The verification and monitoring activities that the agency had in our nuclear facilities based on the JCPOA, as the Director General reflected in his report, actually, all those areas have been stopped, and the agency didn't have any kind of access in accordance with the JCPOA to our nuclear sites and also the nuclear activities in the nuclear facilities.
In his report, IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi estimated Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium to be about 16 times higher than the limit set in the deal. Gharibabadi said Iran is continuing to enrich uranium at the level of 5, 20, and 60%. The limit set in the deal was 3.67%.
There is no suspension in the nuclear activities, such as installation of production, installation of new machines, and also the enrichment level, and the stockpile. So it is very important that actually these kind of activities have not been affected even due to the nuclear negotiation that we have around the JCPOA in Vienna nowadays.
Iran stepped back from its nuclear commitments in response to the previous U.S. administration's withdrawal from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions.
Negotiations to revive the deal have been taking place in Vienna since April, with Tehran standing firm on its position. It will only return to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Homolinsky, Vienna.
After months of despair and a battle against the COVID-19 pandemic, a ray of hope has emerged in several parts of Indian subcontinent as the second wave of the pandemic is showing signs of retreat. The new cases continue to fall for the fourth consecutive day, based on government figures. Health experts and surveys, however, suggest the figures could be 20 times higher than the official figures.
We were overwhelmed by the daily number of cremations till last week, and most of the time there was hardly any calculation. Now it seems there is a slight drop in cases. I hope things are changing now. We pray to God we never get to see such scenes again.
According to a latest study carried out by scientists at the University of Michigan, along with scholars from several institutes, the estimated COVID cases in India could be as high as 492 million till mid-May, which contradicts the Indian official figures of 24 million. The study also puts the overall death toll 4.5 times more than what is officially recorded.
We were struggling last week with the number of patients and dead bodies, and I'm sure there is no proper data about the number of deaths since India is a big country. Cities might have calculations, but there is no calculation about villages.
Many parts of the country have now started gradually opening after weeks of strict lockdowns, which has put a tremendous toll on the country's economic activity. Officials, however, have warned the pandemic is not over, urging people to follow the COVID protocol strictly. Lockdowns aimed at containing the pandemic have now inflicted a heavy toll on the country's economy. Reports suggest the South Asian nation could be headed for a double-digit unemployment rate in the coming weeks, and migrant workers are among the hardest hit. According to official figures, India has registered 28 million COVID cases so far, 25 million have recovered, and about 330,000 have died due to the pandemic. Now the country is battling acute vaccination shortage, while it aims to vaccinate 10 million adults per day from mid-July. Biggest vaccine makers have already started bidding for the contracts after states were directed to buy vaccines directly from the manufacturers. Health experts say it is a mammoth task given the country's geography and the population. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The UK Armed Forces' allure for far-right extremists is believed to be as old as British fascism's earliest incarnations. At least 16 members of the country's armed forces investigated over the past 2.5 years have been referred to the UK's so-called PREVENT scheme, a controversial terrorism prevention program.
The British Army is seen as being a defence of Britain and British values, but those British values are rooted in racism, as I say, and also in its history of colonialism and empire. The British military is in itself a racist institution because Britain is a racist society.
The UK Ministry of Defence is yet to release exact figures, but it says the number of investigations in 2020 was less than 10, and those so far this year, less than 5. Critics say, despite the MOD's stated commitment to zero tolerance for far-right extremists operating within the armed forces, its strong words have not always led to strong action.
Of course the British government's going to say there's a zero tolerance policy, but that is nothing in keeping with the reality when it comes to the culture that exists within the British Army, because of its role, because of its history, because of its legacy, and because of its identity. The far right is on the march, not just in the UK, but throughout the West. This is a result of the socio-economic problems ushered in by the 2008 economic collapse, and the far right have been able to point the fingers at migrants and refugees and existing minority communities as being the problem. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it goes far, far deeper, and I think there's a cover-up abroad in consequence.
Of the 14 investigations carried out in 2019 into serving armed forces personnel, a staggering 11 stem from far-right concerns. And those concerns have been fueled by images such as this one from 2019. British paratroopers using pictures of former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn for target practice.
Last year, the UK's top counter-terrorism officer said the fastest-growing UK terrorist threat came from the far right. A year later, the threat is still there, with critics saying the government is not taking the threat seriously enough. Saeed Pariza, London.
IRIB, the Broadcasting Organization of Iran. The red carpet treatment is being given to the candidates who want to contest in 13th presidential election. Several studios are hosting the seven runners who explain in detail their plans.
The economy under my administration will focus on domestic production and exports. Whatever creates obstacles on that path has to be removed, and whatever strengthens that sector must be paid attention to and boosted. One of my administration's approaches will be to use a strong foreign policy to create international markets to improve our domestic production and exports. We can make the best of the demands in countries in South America, Africa, and South Asia to achieve that end.
Zakani stressed that the next administration has to change course and rely on Iran's domestic capabilities and utilize all regional and international capacities to move towards success. The other candidate, Saeed Jalili, said Iran must not await favors from those who murdered Iranian anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani. He also added that a wrong approach and a weak performance cannot take the country to the summits. Mohsen Rezaei also took the floor to talk to the people regarding his economic agenda.
Some people misunderstood my plans about boosting the national currency. I said we can increase the value of our currency to become the third strongest money in the region after the US dollar and euro. It means that when you go to the exchange market after the first two, Iran's rial would be exchanged the most.
Rezaei also called for reforms in Iran's insurance, banking, and stock market systems. Reformist Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who was speaking at a news network, said that the main problems of the country today are due to macro policies, and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year reign as Israel's prime minister is much likely to end on Sunday. Naftali Bennett, a far-right politician leading Yamina Party, and Yair Lapid, a centrist and opposition leader of Yesh Atid Party, moved closer to forming a coalition after four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years, and Netanyahu's repeated failure to form a coalition. Netanyahu accused Bennett of trying to form a leftist ruling structure that would ensure his rise to premiership. He said that Bennett had been sowing discord, division, and hatred against him.
There are many reasons behind efforts by the Israeli parties working together to oust Netanyahu. He has always declared himself as the only leader of Israel. He has no rival even within his own party. Meanwhile, he has failed to form a coalition so far. Therefore, removing him from the political scene could serve as a strong blow on the Likud and Netanyahu himself.
Bennett said his party would work with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Observers say the alliance between eight relatively small parties with a diffuse range of ideologies won't be easy. But if they succeed, they had agreed that the prime minister's post would rotate between Bennett, a former settler leader who rejects the concept of a sovereign Palestinian state and champions the religious right, and Lapid, who is considered a voice of secular centrists.
It's not an easy mission. We are speaking about the ideological differences between two opposition parties. It's a complex decision for Bennett. They have to tackle lots of problems before forming a cabinet. Moreover, Netanyahu won't remain silent. He may take people with right-wing tendency to the streets to hamper efforts by any future cabinet.
Netanyahu has been holding onto power for the past 12 years. His popularity has, however, suffered an unprecedented plunge among the Israelis, who have been holding regular rallies outside his residence for months on end to force him to resign. Today, experts say nothing must be taken for granted, because what's being described as the anti-Netanyahu cabinet of change is still not an accomplished fact. They say Netanyahu is not simply departing the scene without a fight for remaining in office. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
South Korea is hosting the P4G Seoul Summit on Climate Change, bringing together leaders from more than 60 countries. Held both offline and online, the meeting sought, quote, inclusive green recovery toward carbon neutrality. South Korean President Moon Jae-in pledged more international aid.
We will provide more assistance to developing countries to lay tailored green growth policies. Countries have their own stages of economic development, and thus they also differ on the dependence on coal power. Certainly more assistance is needed to transition into a low carbon economy.
Outside, critics point out that South Korea continues constructing and exporting coal-fired power plants, which generate the most CO2 emissions of all fossil fuels globally, about 30%. South Korea's pledge to end coal power financing. Climate change scientists agree that the COVID-19 pandemic and its lockdowns reduced human activity, which caused a reduction in CO2 emissions. But that reduction in climate-changing pollution will be short-lived. As people drive back to work, factories reopen, and airlines resume their pre-pandemic flight schedules. As the forum took place, environmental activists marched to the venue, critical of the government's carbon record and a new green growth plan to cut down old growth forest to replant young carbon-absorbing trees.
The P4G summit talks about solidarity for green growth, but the climate crisis talks that count on growth are wrong from the start. The current climate crisis is the result of infinite growth for the nation and capital, for power and greed. Even if you put green in front of growth, that's just whitewashing the truth.
P4G Partnering for Green Growth and Global Goals links with the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, which focus on 17 international crises. Urgent action on climate change is number 13. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,800.